The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, a big hello, folks, and welcome everyone to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt, and again today, as I have been doing every week, I'll be helping to take us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, of course, those rich with the essence of constant renewal. Well, I must say, it is hard to talk above the roar going on here in the U.S. this week, and that is about healthcare reform. It is, and it has been, another hugely polarized issue. It has been split largely across party lines, which has resulted so far in what many call, though, the most wide-reaching legislation we have seen in decades. There are both celebrations going on, and there are angry responses. And we have attorney generals from a dozen states who have filed suit in federal courts claiming the legislation is unconstitutional. We have many voices we've been seeing and hearing. Those of the U.S. certainly know, those abroad, perhaps just a couple of reflections. For example, we've had our former Senator Bill Frist, who has expressed, well, many of the real concerns about some of the abilities we might have to control the projected costs in light of our huge deficits and our debt issues. Those are conversations we've had on Zoomed as well. And we have former Surgeon General David Satcher calling it the first step toward a real healthcare reform. So there's much conversation, there's much action, there's much on the dance floor here, and I think it's appropriate and important, as we do on Zoom so often, is to get up on the balcony and be clear about some aspects of what is really going on. And in this respect, I'd like to start with maybe two opening points here. And first, as my guest today, I think, will reflect back, this legislation is, to a great extent, around insurance reform. It has emphasis on access, coverage, and costs. It's important and necessary, but not necessarily sufficient to address the real reform of the system at large. What we're addressing in this bill and in this legislation has to do with perhaps about 20 to 25% of the real issues of health and costs. Little of it has to do with prevention, with wellness, or with lifestyle, which are the underpinnings of the 75 to 80% of true health care and its associated costs. In my guest's words, I think you'll hear we have a system at play that is pulling bodies out of the disease river and not yet focusing on ways to prevent bodies getting into the river in the first place. I think it's an interesting metaphor, and that, my folks, is point one. Second has to do with perhaps the process that we consider that is at play at the governmental and the congressional level. Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig and author Glenn Greenwald, as I have seen it over the weekend, have been describing our recent experiences as a congressional system that is broken. In their words, President Obama was victorious in playing the game absolutely brilliantly. And that is an old game having to do with lobbyists, undue influence, and massive benefits to special interests, and in this case, reaping immense benefit to pharma and big insurance to affirm their support. The price paid by the president, we might ask ourselves, how much reform can this administration or nation afford? It's a question not associated directly and only with President Obama. It's a question for us as a nation relative to our Congress. In Lessing's words again, unless we're willing to challenge the broken system in Washington, and I might even add the state houses that are involved and the in-the-mud kind of dimensions involved in it, unless we stop letting lobbyists use our clout to get their way with a Congress addicted to campaign cash, nothing else is going to change, especially real systemic change. That's kind of a perspective that I bring out. So, folks, we are continuing a logjam at the top. We have made some progress for sure. It's certainly something to be recognized, and we can only hope that this might awaken the president from what some are calling conventional politics stupor. And as Lessing so boldly suggests, we must fix Congress first. But we haven't. So we must also continue the through line of our show here on Zoomed. As my guest has said, I think we have focused on both the treetops and on the grassroots, our communities. That's where we have real and true innovation that's occurring and on a widespread basis. Our title of our show today, Innovation in Community. And my guest is at the forefront of both healthcare and change at the community level. My guest is Dr. Robert K. Ross, President and CEO of California Endowment, which was started in 1996 to address health needs of Californians. During Bob's tenure, the foundation has focused on underserved Californians by championing health coverage for all children, strengthening community health centers, improving services for farm workers and ex-offenders, and increasing racial and ethnic diversity in health professions. It's been named California Weekly, one of California's most influential civic leaders. I would say beyond that, I would say more nationally in recognition. He has a broad background as clinician, public health administrator, served as the director of human health services for San Diego County, commissioner of public health for Philadelphia, medical director of Link School-based clinic program in New Jersey. Many awards. I can go on and on. You can hear the experience. Bob, it is great to have you with us at this really timely moment in our history here.
Well, a wonderful introduction, John, and one that qualified enough I might send to my mother, so I appreciate that. But flattered to be here on Zoomed and a historic week to talk about healthcare in this country.
Well, it is a historic week here, and I think not only I, but I know many of the colleagues I have and listeners are delighted to have you on to really explore this in many fashions, in many directions here. But I do have to ask this question because we were talking about it over dinner last night. And for you personally, Bob, because we like the up close and personal here, where did this move come from you, from moving from a physician and engaging with patients to getting up on the balcony more to the systemic level and thinking about it in the varying roles that I've described? How did that all start, and where, when and how did that start for you?
Yeah, thank you, John. I am I cut my teeth in my health career as a pediatrician. I was trained in Philadelphia at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and my first job coming out of that pediatric residency training program was at a community health center in Camden, New Jersey, which is right across the river from Philadelphia, very low income, and to this day remains a disinvested community. And I landed there to practice pediatrics in 1983, which was wonderful, and I had a great time learning my craft and helping the patients. And then between 1984 and 1986, I had an awakening that was both sobering and illuminating at the same time, where that was when the epidemic of crack cocaine swept through urban communities across the country. And the reason why it's relevant to where I am today is before 1984, poor people couldn't buy cocaine. Cocaine was a drug that was considered sort of a weekend designer kind of drug because you just couldn't, if you didn't have more than $100 in your pocket, you just couldn't buy it. And whenever the evil genius was that invented crack, the crack version of cocaine, the price point for cocaine now went from $100 and up to as low as $5. And cocaine is a rapidly metabolized, short-acting, very pleasurable, almost euphoric kind of drug. And you get through it. Unlike morphine or heroin, the drug doesn't last in your body a very long time, and you metabolize it quickly. So it's a short, quick, intense high. And so when we saw low-income communities that were disinvested, relatively certainly impoverished, as well as varying levels of hopelessness and lack of opportunity, it was as if someone had dropped the public health version of a nuclear bomb on Camden. Mm-hmm. We saw very quickly, and I saw it just spilling into my office and spilling into our emergency room and the hospital that I practiced at as well. For example, low birth weight babies, just the rate of low birth weight births and premature births just went through the roof, because many women who became addicted to crack cocaine, A, either stopped keeping up with their prenatal care appointments, or B, the pharmacological effect that cocaine and crack cocaine has on the uterus. The uterus is essentially a large muscle. It's a muscular organ, and cocaine is a muscular stimulant. So these babies were now being birthed at 24 weeks, 25 weeks, 26 weeks, 6 months of gestation, rather than the usual 9 months. So we saw that was the onset of the crack baby.
Wow.
A baby that was born into very difficult and tough social conditions, but also was born not physiologically ready to inhabit the earth. We saw community violence just skyrocket, particularly in young people, as drug gangs began to sprout up new ways for young people, young men in particular, who were hopeless, who didn't want to make minimum wage at McDonald's and wanted to take the fast track to getting a great new car and great clothes. And so they would, form drug gangs to protect their turf and their businesses. We saw domestic violence increase in families. We saw sexually transmitted disease, HIV, AIDS, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, all increase as well. So all of these things were happening as crack cocaine visited the community that I was serving. And what was extraordinary to me, John, was I had trained at a fairly sophisticated, very highly reputed medical school and residency training program. But I felt at such a loss as to what was happening in this community that I was serving and the families I was treating, that I actually got quite bitter and frustrated that what I was experiencing for the first time up front and close is what in the vernacular is known as the social determinants of health. In other words, poverty is bad for your health. Mm-hmm. And lifestyle matters, and conditions matter, and hopelessness matters. And there was nothing in my black bag. There was no vaccine. There was no course I had taken anywhere in my medical school or residency training that prepared me for what I was dealing with at that point in time. And I began to just say, wait a minute. Again, as you mentioned, we're pulling these bodies out of the river in terms of these kids and families and young people that are now broken and need emergency and urgent healthcare intervention. But how do I get upstream to talk about how policies and systems and communities and lifestyle really influence health? And later, to close in this story, my experience. The research affirmed my experience, and the research now, up until now, is the public health research, is that fully 75% to 80% of what influences our life expectancy and our quality of health life has nothing to do with doctors, or little to do with doctors and hospitals and clinics and health insurance. There's a great deal to do with your lifestyle, the community you live in, and those influences. And moreover, 9 of the 10 leading causes of death in Americans right now at the top are things like cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, emphysema, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which are attributable to smoking. And then you've got injuries and accidents, many of them preventable from drinking and driving and drug use. 9 of those 10 leading causes of death and morbidity in this country that are costing this country a lot of money are fully preventable and influenced by lifestyle. And so that, for me, led to a shift where I began a career in public health to get from the ground level up to the balcony, if you will, and think about a community as a patient rather than an individual.
And Bob, I think that's what's so compelling about our conversation today, because you have that background. You're able to really feel the depth of it in the social context, with the sense of helplessness, with the communities, with people who are down there and actually on the streets with this. And that's the connecting the dots, I think, that's very important relative to the health issues, relative to this legislation, and to the work of the endowment. But Bob, I can hear the music in my ears here for our first break, but I think that's a wonderful introduction and a context that'll be a useful bridge on it. Let's take a short break. Let's come back. Our guest today, Dr. Bob Ross, CEO, California Endowment. Our conversation is healthcare. Our conversation is innovation in community. You can begin to get a feel for the depth of where the underpinning of Bob's background will take us and how that can be brought to life in the work at the endowment now. Back in a few minutes. We'll continue the conversation. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. The experts are here. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880, or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind. From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoomed on this Monday. We're with Bob Ross here. Our conversation around healthcare, our conversation around innovative approaches to healthcare and what's being done in community. Bob, let me come back, because I think that was a wonderful start to ground that in terms of the context of it and the nature of the system that we're talking about. What's your comments, though? We just had legislation passed. You've really started to point to some prevention. What's your picture, and how would you describe what you've seen with the recent legislation?
Well, we're certainly, those of us that have been advocates for a fair and just health system for Americans, and I really emphasize fairness because it really has been an unfair system, we're elated. Elated, I think, particularly on the fairness part of this, John, as an African American, I do have a sensitivity and sensibility to the issue of civil rights, and I believe the healthcare system that we've had that this legislation attempts to begin to fix has been an unjust, unfair civil rights issue, because people who are sick are discriminated against in our healthcare system. And I think that's the most salient feature of the legislation that just got passed, because it basically says Americans who are sick should not be discriminated against in terms of accessing and purchasing healthcare. And up until now, they have been. And it always has struck me as unfair and un-American. So I think this legislation goes a long way in terms of dealing with the pre-existing issue, conditions issue. Much has been written and said about that. That's quite good. Trying to get these cooperative exchanges so folks can have access to better prices in terms of purchasing care. That's been talked about. We think that's very valuable. It is largely an insurance and affordability reform. There are a couple of good things in there around the matter of prevention. There are more dollars for community health centers, which focus more on primary care and prevention, again, trying to get at the front end of the healthcare delivery system. There are some new dollars for prevention approaches. I also believe that for Medicare recipients, there's some preventive services as well. So it's a good start. I guess what I'm sobered by, and you mentioned this in your opening preamble, the blood that's on the floor in Congress to get to this thing is pretty sobering. It's the car got to the destination, but boy, it's a wreck. I don't know what it means politically for our country, but hopefully we can get to that later in the show. So I'm very pleased with what Congress has done, and sobered by how divisive and bloody and dysfunctional it has shown our Congress to be in getting there. That said, what the potential is here. Think of what has just been passed as health reform 1.0.
And that's a good way to put it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is how do we make what is essentially we talk about it. We use the term. The media use the term very frequently, describing our health system. Well, it's not a health system. It's not about health. It's really not a system. A system is something that's integrated and works as parts of a whole. And our system is anything. It's a non-system, and it's really not about health. It's about sickness. And that's why our system is so expensive. 97 cents on every dollar that's spent in this country in health is spent on health care. It's spent in hospitals, in emergency rooms, in surgery suites, in doctor's offices, and in specialty offices. Less than 3 cents on every health care dollar, the $2.2 trillion that's spent, will be spent on prevention. And so this legislation begins to address that in some baby steps in ways that are meaningful, but will not go far enough. And I'm not complaining about what was passed, but I'm just saying what we need to do is to get to health reform 2.0, which is how do we transform a sickness system into a wellness system. And a wellness system because it's in the best interest of this country in terms of worker productivity, in terms of controlling costs, in terms of children being healthy enough to attend school and do well in school, in order for Americans to be healthy enough to compete in an increasingly globally competitive marketplace. And so this notion that we see the healthcare system and paying for healthcare as this luxurious add-on, it is equivalent to the military or public defense or public safety. Interestingly, John, I'd to digress for a minute, but as an example, one of the efforts that we're working on is obesity prevention, particularly child obesity prevention, and particularly in low-income communities.
Mm-hmm.
I received a call from an organization called, I think it's Invest, Fight Crime, Invest for Kids. Anyway, it's an organization of roughly, I guess their board is 40 retired generals and admirals, military leaders.
Wow, that's interesting.
Who want to work with us because they are deeply concerned about the burgeoning and relentless childhood obesity epidemic. They're worried about what it means for military readiness. Because right now, the biggest reason why young Americans are not passing their physical in the various military venues is obesity.
Oh, really? Well, wow.
And so that tells me, wow, this is not just a health issue. This is a national productivity and security issue. We've got to get this nation healthier, and we have the capacity to do it.
Well, it's interesting, Bob. You're saying two things that really catch my attention here. One is reframing the issue relative to sickness to wellness. I mean, that puts a very tangible picture in your mind and the difference between that. It is something very different in the two. And the other is, it strikes me out of this, you know, in business where I spend an awful lot of time, we always think about the root cause and try to follow back through where it actually starts. Or in the environmental movement, we talk about, well, you got pollution, you've got end of pipe solutions, but you try to come back upstream to where it is. Seems to me that's what I'm hearing out of the generals as well. They're recognizing this is an upstream issue where you actually need to go to the source, and the source is around wellness, and it's a shift in our whole mindset away from sickness. And that's very significant. That seems like a real leadership perspective too.
Yeah, to the extent, John, that, you know, sometimes what helps you, you know, those of us in the public health world, and that's the world I come from, we've been pounding the pavement on this for years, and it feels like decades even, that no one has listened. And sometimes it's not the messaging, it's the messengers. And this is a leadership challenge where we do need new voices and new messengers from unusual suspects to talk about the importance of prevention, the importance of a wellness system. And so when we hear faith leaders and business leaders and military leaders saying that we've got to do something about this, now all of a sudden the issue is getting traction. And it's just a reminder that sometimes leadership is not about new messaging, but recruiting new messengers.
Well, it's interesting, and it's also saying it's not just residing in a few with a certain position and a certain placement in Congress or someplace else. You're describing here, this is in the faith community, the community at large, or the military. You're talking about people just exercising leadership and really the act of leadership and where that comes in and where that comes in from different voices with different messages. That's an interesting piece to it. But I think, Bob, it's interesting about this whole realm here, and there's the relationship of this to communities, and I know we've only got a minute or two in this segment left, but I think this whole arena of this legislation still, and with the challenges you're describing as well, pointing to Congress and the difficulties out of that and what the reality we might be living with, it points to the fact that there is the community underpinning to this. And I'm curious to talk more about the endowment, but maybe just in the minute we have left, can you give us just a short summary of the focus and intent of the endowment and where you put your emphasis and what it's about?
Sure. We were created in 1996, and I'll save the story of how we were created, but we were endowed with a fair amount of resources with a mission to improve the health of underserved and low-income Californians. And we've chosen to execute that mission through the lens of prevention, just because there's so little resources focusing strategically on prevention and thinking about wellness systems and reframing the paradigm of redefining the paradigm of what a healthcare system looks like. And right now, we're trying to advance a paradigm, John, which says that the healthcare system is not doctors and clinics and hospitals. A healthcare system is our community.
Mm-hmm.
And let's think about a community as a system, and how do we provide community residents, parents, family members with better options and opportunities to be healthy? How do we not help people beat the odds, but how do we change the odds for them to be healthy?
Great. And I think along that, I think what we've talked to, and we've talked, Bob, you've described that the function and the role and the way you've been in the midst of this, you've had some 8,000 grants really disseminated to varying parts of the community to engage in a multiplicity of efforts to bring this focus on prevention alive. And I'd love to get to that in our next segment, talk more about it, to get more about the nature of the community, what's really been working, what have you been learning, what can we really take out of this, recognizing that so much of this, not only in healthcare but other issues, is really at the community center. And I'd love to really hear more about it in the context. But let's take a short break. I hear the music building in my ear here. Wonderful conversation, Bob, and I'm really want to continue as a through line on this with continuing observations to the legislation and where this might ultimately go. But let's take a short break, folks. We'll be back. We'll continue innovation in community in just a minute. Come back. Thanks.
We'll be right back. Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now. Toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership? Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880 or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back again today. Bob Ross, our guest, Innovation Community, our focus point, what does work on the ground? How is this brought to life in terms of social challenges, the intelligent responses? But Bob, let me pose the question first to go back, because I think it was a good one that as you started to introduce the notion of community. What's your sense in this realm of healthcare and other and associated issues? Why is community so key?
Well, I think for two reasons. One is out of necessity, John. I think you know what you described in your opening commentary about Washington and its pervasive just bickering and partisan fallout. This is happening in Sacramento. It's happening in Albany. It's happening in not only in it's not that Washington is an outlier. But this sort of right-wing versus left-wing ideological bickering is leading to dysfunction all over the place, which means we just can't it's getting increasingly difficult to depend on our political leaders to provide leadership for solving the problem. So that's one reason. The second reason is in our experience, the folks best equipped to solve the problems and drive the innovations are the ones that are experiencing the problems firsthand. Mm-hmm. And that's at the level, in our business, that's at the grassroots level. And even in low income and some of the most disinvested and poorest communities in the country, there is leadership and innovation and passion and creativity in those communities that if given some degree of resources and an opportunity will show that they can solve some problems. And so it's another paradigm shift in viewing low income and working class communities, disinvested communities even, rather than viewing them as needy of services, as supplicants for services, as folks with a handout, viewing them as authentic architects for social change and innovation. Mm-hmm. And we've spent, as you mentioned, well more than $1 billion over 10 plus years, and we've made 8,000 grants to nearly more than 3,000 different community and grassroots organizations, looking for you know, investing in their ideas, looking for things that work. And I'll give you a couple, just to make this conversation less abstract and more concrete, I'll just give you a couple.
Great examples will be great, Bob. Terrific.
So on the example the research has shown that as it relates to your health, place matters. Where you live matters. If you want to find out in general, statistically, how long you will live on this planet. Give me your zip code, and I'll tell you how long you'll live. Okay. So the life expectancy in Brentwood or Pacific Palisades or Marin County in California is substantially different than in South Central Los Angeles or Boyle Heights in East L.A. or in Richmond, California. And that's because of the impact of place, which also has a great impact on a great determinant of poverty. And so what we found in the communities, particularly disinvested low-income communities, and I'll take one example, that the Community Coalition, which is an organization we fund in, we support in South Central Los Angeles, very grassroots organization, situated in the middle of South Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles. And just to give you a quick tour of South Central Los Angeles, still a disinvested community that never made the turnaround in any meaningful way, even since the Rodney King riots in 92, and a community still struggling for an identity of opportunity. And this is a community where part of the reason why health is so bad in that community, you have high violence rates, high obesity rates, high stroke, high hypertension, high heart attacks. Everything is sort of off the charts in that neighborhood. Violence for sure. Many gang-dominated communities. And so in those communities, families don't feel that it's safe to work, play, exercise, shop. These communities are what we call food deserts. They have little or no access to full-service grocery stores that we take for granted in the communities that many of us live in.
I think that's really significant, Bob, even to point out there, because I don't think that many really realize the food deserts that are really out there.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, interrupt you, but I mean, that just strikes home. We were talking about that the other day. I don't think that people recognize how much when you walk down into, you know, middle-class America with grocery stores in every corner, what a barren state that might be there.
Exactly. This is why we, on the matter of obesity prevention and childhood obesity, John, we don't come at this with a personal responsibility frame. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't a role for personal responsibility. Of course there is. But if you live in a community where you're raising a couple of kids, say they're 9 and 11 years old, and the neighborhood is gang-dominated, and there's no full-service grocery store, that means your kids have no place to exercise. That means that they don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And surprise, and they're inside because that's a safe place for them to be. Mom is keeping them inside. And so, lo and behold, surprise, surprise, the kids are overweight. Now, the Community Coalition is an organization that has figured out how you begin to transform the unhealthy elements in a community, in a neighborhood, and turn them over time. It doesn't happen overnight. Into sort of changing the landscape to a healthier place. So what they do is they have figured out how to close down crack houses. They have figured out how to close down liquor stores where high rates of violence often occur in a community. They have figured out how to close down motels in South Los Angeles. And I can hear your audience now saying, motels, what do you mean? So South Los Angeles, nothing resembling a vacation hotspot in this country, has lots of motels. And these are not Holiday Inn Express. These are mom-and-pop run shops that harbor prostitution, drug deals, and transients. And if you just drive up and down the streets of South Los Angeles, in a lot of communities in California across the country, you find these little seedy motels that are just breeding crime, breeding unhealthy behavior, and rendering the neighborhood unsafe and certainly not a place where business wants to invest in. So they have figured out, using, for example, these are grassroots community leaders, elderly and young people, they use GIS mapping to identify the nuisance, unhealthy breeding business establishments in the community and figured out how to persuade law enforcement, city council, and elected officials with data about the number of these establishments, be they homes, crack houses, or these motels, or these liquor establishments. So, you know, these are the parts of our community that are making our place, our community, an unhealthy and unsafe place to be, and we want you to shut them down. Now, it's not as simple as it's rolling over my tongue, but the community residents mobilized with their voice, but also with data. And that combination of knowing how to use data, knowing how to use a reasonably sophisticated GIS mapping system to make their case, and they have figured out how to close more than, over the years, 200 of these new establishments, and try to begin to replace them with you know, full service grocery stores and other kinds of positive businesses. So that's one example of an innovation where a community, a set of community grassroots leaders are learning how to transform their neighborhood and transform that place from an unhealthy place to a healthy one.
But Bob, what I'm really liking, you're using an example here which has more broad application. I can really clearly hear it in the community relative to what we're talking about, health and prevention. But really what you're talking about is getting a handle of understanding about the community, a more broad community system, and all the different piece parts that fits into that, and the grassroots connection of people in being able to look at it and engage with it and come up with new solutions and come up with actions. But most of all, Bob, you know what really strikes me is that you're changing in what the foundation is doing there, the endowment is doing, is you're providing money, you're providing support, you're fueling this, but it's not focusing on charity. You're focusing on change.
Exactly.
Is that an accurate way to reflect back on that?
That's perfectly an accurate way, John. I think in our early years as a foundation, we did a lot more charity work where we're funding, you know, services, and these are not. Don't get me wrong. These are food banks, homeless shelters, domestic violence shelters. Need that kind of private sector charity support. But the highest and best use of our dollars, in our view, is how do we change systems so that people have an opportunity to be healthy and prevent domestic violence, prevent homelessness, prevent mental health issues, prevent obesity. One other example, if I have time, John.
Actually, we've only got about 30 seconds in this segment, so let's hold that, because I think these examples are really crisp, and they allow, I think, Bob, us to get up on the balcony and see the applicability in what we're talking about here. But the applicability, if we were talking about another issue and problem, you know, how do we deal with energy issues and problems that might be coming, whatever it might be, you're really pointing to the community and the ground of that, Bob. So, but finish what you're saying. I think we don't have time for another example. We're down about 30 seconds here in this segment. But I would like to continue this to get more of a sense of where does this go and what are the learnings from engaging this at the same time, Bob.
Yeah, what we found, just to close in this segment, John, is innovation is really important. It matters. But what we found that is more difficult to do is once you actually find and discover an innovation that works to address a particular either health problem or social challenge, the bigger impediment and barrier is how do you scale it up to systemic-wide change? And I'll have an example of that when we come back.
And I think that's beautiful, because I think we are talking about scale here. We are talking about the communities and how to really build this, learn from community to community, how to scale it in your own community. Let's continue with this. Bob Ross with us. I think it's a rich conversation, innovation in community, lessons learned. We'll come back on that in a minute. Take a short break. Last segment. Thanks. Come back.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The world is in flux, primed for a great transition, possibly an epical one. How does it impact you? Does it reshape the questions you ask? The way you view leadership. Today's complexities and challenges call for new realms of leadership. The world needs resilience and adaptability, new levels of innovation and brilliance. At Avastone Consulting, we know that our times call for shifts of mind. How do we cultivate real shifts of mind in our leaders? Not through conventional development, which focuses on gaining skills and knowledge within an established worldview. Shifts of mind truly expand the worldview itself, enlarge the capacity to see through new eyes, and transform interpretations of reality and the actions that accompany them. Those who embrace shifts of mind are the kind of leaders that Avastone helps to build. Change the way you pursue the future. Call Avastone Consulting at 1-678-461-8880. That's 1-678-461-8880. Or visit avastoneconsulting.com. Avastone Consulting, your source for leadership development, working with complex organizations toward evolutionary shifts of mind.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's AvastoneConsulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back. Last segment, Bob Ross on this Monday. We're talking about innovation in community. We're talking about what works on the ground. We're talking about social challenges, the intelligent responses with some example. We left it last time talking about how actually and what has been learned about this relative to scaling that innovation, Bob. Maybe we can pick up on that and sort of move toward bringing all this together in this last segment. But say more about that. Scale, how do you scale, and give us an example or just even thoughts about that.
Yeah, let me try. Hopefully, John, I can be more surgical with these two next examples, but they really point to system-wide challenges. So I'm going to talk a little about gangs and prisons. And one doesn't, in our reframing of the paradigm of health and healthcare, you would never think about the gang problem or the prisons problem as part of a healthcare problem, but it is. Both gangs and prisons produce lots of disease, lots of suffering, and costs this country in terms of taxpayer costs a tremendous amount of money. On the gang side, there is an organization we fund, led by a terrific grassroots leader, faith leader, a priest named Father Greg Boyle, who runs an organization called Homeboy Industries, which is a gang prevention, gang intervention a program based here in East Los Angeles, but now becoming a national model. And what they do is they get kids out of the gang life and out of La Vida Loca and try and turn them into young people who can finish and getting their degree, be it a GED or high school diploma or community college degree, but doing it by providing economic development and workforce opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And what Father Greg Boyle likes to say is nothing stops a bullet like a job. and what the way Homeboy Industries works, it's sort of the newer entrepreneurial version of the community-based nonprofit. Yeah, they raise money and from private donations, and we're one of their funders, but they have three or four lines of business at Homeboy Industries. They have a bakery, they have a T-shirt printing business, they have a homegirl cafe, which is a restaurant that's run by the women that are coming out of the gangs and girls. They have a landscaping business. They're not totally self-sufficient yet in terms of the businesses and supporting the gang intervention programs, but they're beginning to get there. So that's one model of how you take a nasty, pervasive gang problem, which is endemic to Los Angeles and to California, and begin to say, wait a minute, we still believe in these kids. We can give them an opportunity and get them out of the gang life.
Great example.
And what we need is for our juvenile justice systems and probation systems, where these kids are often buried and are literally inmates in waiting, and turn the entire probation and juvenile justice system into that kind of economic development entrepreneurial model. So that's one example. A second example is an organization we fund in Southeast San Diego called Second Chance. Second Chance does prison reentry work. And two things happen when prisoners leave a prison and go back to their community. They can either they've learned their lesson and become productive citizens, become gainfully employed, or they can come back and continue to wreak the havoc in the community through violence and drug use or drug selling, or gang involvement that got him back in jail in the first place. And the data to this point, at least in the state of California, and much of the national experience, is that fully 70 to 80% of inmates who leave prison recidivate or end up back in prison or in a criminal justice system within 3 years.
Well,
the Second Chance program, which we fund, which is a grassroots program run by ex-felons and ex-inmates, a very energetic guy named Scott Silverman is their CEO, and Scott's a recovering alcoholic himself, and is just a marvelous guy. But his staff and his program architects are all ex-felons. And a three-year study of our grant to them, because they have a new model, a new way, we don't have time to go into their what's new about what they do, but they've had an 80% success rate in 3 years of keeping folks not only out of prison, but gainfully employed. And so they have completely reversed what the state of California's correctional system experience is, because they have brought a real grassroots, authentic experience to what it takes to run a program. And their cost per client, John, is between $5,000 and $6,000 per client per year, when the cost for having someone in prison is $35,000, $40,000 to $45,000 per inmate per year.
Wow, now that's innovating cost, that's innovating service, that's innovating value in the community, that's innovating an approach to the systemic problem. That's a great example on that.
It's extraordinary. So we have an innovation that works, and they're not alone. There are others that are doing this. But how do you take the entire criminal justice system and correctional system and give it that kind of value? And also what it does, John, if you can do that, you begin to restore faith and hope in the taxpayers that their dollars are not wasted by ineffective and dysfunctional programs, and that's in many ways is at the root of the distrust and even hatred of government and taxes these days, is folks don't feel like their taxes are providing value.
Yeah, I think that's right. But what I really like that you're really talking about here is you're reframing this. You're talking about the reframing the paradigm of healthcare, but this can be applicable as a metaphor for others. But you've talked about, Bob, sickness to wellness. You've reframed charity to change. You've reframed the supplicants for services to authentic architects, owning it in community. And you've been describing the way the community is coming together, collecting each other, really engaging with each other, looking at the source of these problems and intervening directly in the community. I think it's a great example of what happens locally without as much support and not relying on Sacramento or Washington. This is a real empowerment feel to it, and it really feels like there's a sovereignty to it that we've been talking about on Zoomed relative to the commons, our culture, our communities at large, that we're regaining a sovereignty from what you're describing here. Is that accurate?
I think it's perfectly accurate, John. I think they're not waiting for permission from Washington or Sacramento to solve these problems. They're just solving them. And again, I just to bring out for 30 seconds the political scientist in me and an amateur one at that. This is what Tocqueville found when he came to this country in the 1820s and said, how is this thing called democracy working? And he looked at the org chart, of course, of how this country is governed, but he also recognized and noted in his book, Democracy in America, back in the 1820s or 1830s, he said, you know, there's this really interesting phenomenon where community leaders just come together and solve problems. And they don't wait for permission from anyone to do it. They just get it done. And this strikes me as a very interesting and surprising feature of this nascent democracy. And in my view, truer today even than when Tocqueville was here. And if we can just spend a little more time thinking about the innovation and creativity that comes from the grassroots level, I think we'd all be better off for it.
Well, I think we'd be better off for it, but it seems to me that with the logjam we have in Washington, we can't rely on solutions elsewhere. Otherwise, we're going to be sitting here holding our hands up going, nothing's happening, because it just is so difficult in that perspective. We've got just maybe under 2 minutes here. Bob, I'm wondering, any thoughts that you have about the logjam? I mean, you've been into Sacramento. You've been into Washington. I know you've supported and worked with Michelle Obama on the obesity piece on it. Any thoughts you have about this logjam? Logjam, the polarity, any final thoughts as we kind of bridge out for the show this week?
Yeah, I guess, and I'm an optimist, John, so this is the optimist point of view. I think we're on the verge of a completely redefining what leadership and problem solving looks like in this country. clear recognition that Washington and other state capitals and the political process is either paralyzed or broken or dysfunctional. And I think it's going to be enlightened, bolder, and emboldened community, civic leaders, business leaders that are civic minded, that are just fed up with the dysfunction in state and national capitals, and that will begin to see entrepreneurism just redefined, not only in how ideas come forward, but in how those ideas that need to be scaled up are supported. And I think you'll see in public education reform, in affordable housing, in homelessness, in healthcare, in correctional systems, I think you'll see the leadership for changing these systems and the imperative and demand of these systems, these dysfunctional systems, be changed through new ideas. I think you'll see a whole new range of partnerships out of the private sector, the nonprofit sector, and the business sector that will say these things must change, and we're back in charge now. And so that's my optimistic point of view, and maybe we can schedule a show about 10 years from now to figure out what we're
doing. Well, I'd like to schedule one before that one, Bob, to continue this conversation. But I think you really tuned into that has been the optimism we've been talking about here on Zoomed as well, that the potential that's available to us in our communities and to us first as individuals and expressing the passion within, deep within our own bellies, within our own souls, how that connects with others. How do we embrace the community? Last week we were talking about transition towns, thinking about peak oil. We've had Erica Allen on talking about growing power and how do we build food, locally grown food in communities, in the disadvantaged parts of the communities. I mean, this is the source of the conversation. That is not only the hope, it seems to me, Bob, that I share this with you. That is the way. It is the way we're going to engage our path forward, our positive futures and the desirable futures we want. But let me say again, thanks for joining us here today. I would love to continue this conversation, and my hat's off and applaud for the great work you're doing out there with the endowment.
My pleasure, John. It's just been a real pleasure to share the story with you on Zoomed.
Well, thank you, and I think we'll love to continue it and reflect back on this, and on behalf of the audience, again, a pleasure to be here. So that's it today, this week. Bob Ross, Conversation Healthcare, certainly part one. We'll continue even further with this as we go on. I think it's a rich conversation for all of us, and I think it's a continuing metaphor, as Bob has said so well, about leadership and the expression and what we all might learn and take and actually express ourselves in the communities. Next week, we'll continue the conversation in a different quarter as with healthcare here, California Endowment transitioning next week into the business arena. Our guest, Jeffrey Hollander, co-founder, executive chair, chief inspired protagonist of Seventh Generation. He has a new book, The Responsibility Generation. We talked a little bit about responsibility in the system, and that it's not only about responsibility, it certainly transcends it. That next week, we'll talk more about what Jeffrey is really thinking about. Again, love to have you guys join us week to week. It's a pleasure. Enjoy. And I share with Bob, we have great optimism when we bring this to bear together. Thanks. Have a good week. Talk to you next Monday. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.